Good morning. My name is Frank Herrmann, as Daniele just said. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak this morning. It's been a wonderful conference so far. Already learned a lot of very interesting things. Looking forward to the rest of it. You've already seen a bunch of SpinFoam talks, well, mostly machines talks yesterday, giving you an overview. If you went to the parallel sessions, Simona gave a wonderful overview of what's been going on in the last few years in SpinFoams. I'll focus on a more narrow topic, which is the asymptotic regime of SpinFoams. Just briefly to recall, in case you weren't there, or also to kind of introduce my perspective, SpinFoam models are a discrete, that is, we are on a lattice with faces, edges, and vertices model that is built using some notion of discrete quantized geometry. And they're intended to provide a covariant dynamics for network states. Spin network states, but also generalizations thereof. There have been, as Simona said, over 100 papers in the last year. Impossible to do justice to them all. Many, many collaborators, 100 papers in the last 2 years. Many collaborators going back to the late 90s. People from almost every letter of the alphabet. Oops. Seems my... Well, that's the conclusions. Don't look at the last slide. So what are they? I said it's sort of what I said so far, covariant picture for network states. That's sort of a very general picture. To fill that with life, to really get physics out of this picture, you need a little bit more of a perspective. And there we actually start to differ. There are different perspectives how to interpret the SpinFoam models, depending on what your perspective is. What a SpinFoam model should be, you're going to come to very different conclusions with respect to what you should do with the models that we have. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. There are some of these approaches have a lot more work to them than others. For example, if you want to construct topological quantum field theories from them, I think there's not that much work going on, though the mathematicians are very interested. John Barrett and Catherine Moisburg are still working on that. But there's certainly an order of magnitude fewer than in sort of the loop quantum gravity picture. I'll try to stay neutral with respect to these debates. But when I'm not, I'll have the lattice gauge gravity picture in mind. That is, I want to interpret the lattice in a similar way as you would in a lattice gauge Young-Mills theory with, you know, taking into account the fact that we're in a gravitational system that's background independent, therefore we'll have many different properties then, and the continuum limit and all these issues will look very different in this case than in the lattice Young-Mills case. To get a little bit more concrete, so we have a two complex here with faces, edges, and vertices. You saw this in machine's talk yesterday already. We have face weights that depend on the face labels, edge weights that depend on the edge labels, and vertex weights that depend on both of them. And these are not all made the same. These we usually interpret as measure factors, and this is the important part. Where, that's in quotation marks, obviously, there's a lot of very hard and interesting questions about these measure factors. But this is the thing that usually gets your name, gets your model named after you, if you come up with a new one of those. I said that this is some sort of quantized geometry going into the construction of these. Where does this quantized geometry come from? The quantized geometry lies mostly in the labels that we put on our two complex, these J's and the I's. These J's and I's are SE2 representation theoretic data. So the J's are representations. The I's are intertwiners, that is, elements of the trivial subspace of this tensor product of representations, the trivial representation. And this representation theoretic data has a very interesting interpretation, a very interesting origin, can be interpreted as the quantization of the space of convex polyhedra. This is an interpretation that always comes up again. So we have some convex polyhedra here, which is, and we are looking at the shape of, the space of shapes of these three-dimensional geometries. So fixing the areas, I still have a lot of freedom how my tetrahedron in this case should look. This is a two-dimensional space. It has a nice symplectic structure. I can quantize it. If I quantize it, I end up with this Hilbert space. Now, what's asymptotics? Asymptotics is the classical limit that takes me back from this quantized geometry to this discrete geometry that I started with. So one way to see that is that I can build states that are peaked on these classical shape variables. For example, Atra and Simona taught us how to do that in 07, a very, very influential paper. The entire spinner twister framework really brings out sort of these sort of geometric interpretations as well. I won't be talking too much about that. And if I take the asymptotic regime, and by that I mean that I put the J's large, these states become approximately orthogonal. So my Hilbert space, they form an overall complete basis. So my Hilbert space goes back to sort of the classical phase space of discrete 3D geometry. If I now take these states and put them into the vertex asymptotics, what will that teach me? It teaches me what my quantum geometry, what my quantum amplitude does when I put a classical discrete geometry into it. Take the classical discrete geometry in the form of the asymptotic coherent states peaked on particular phase space points, put it into the quantum amplitude. What does the quantum amplitude do with this thing? What does it tell me? Well, briefly, how do we get the vertex amplitude? Again, Machine said a lot about that yesterday. We get the vertex amplitude by taking five of these intertwiners, so five of these quantized geometries, 3D geometries, embedding them in four-dimensional representations, and gluing this in a four-dimensionally invariant way. Don't want to go too much into detail. The point is sort of geometrically, you should think of these looking like five tetrahedra gluing together to give you a four simplex that is a four-dimensional equivalent of a tetrahedron. We do the asymptotics. What do we find? These are the classic results. We find that there's a geometric sector and a topological sector. What do I mean with a geometric sector and a topological sector? I have a discrete boundary geometry. That's 3D tetrahedra. I put them on the boundary. And what the amplitude tells me is it doesn't like them. It doesn't eat them. It discards them unless I can continue this 3D boundary geometry to a continuous interior geometry. If I can continue to interior bulk geometry, 40 flat bulk geometry, what I get is an amplitude that's proportional to the cosine of the Reggie action. Well, there's another set of solutions, in which case I cannot continue them to a metric geometry on the inside, this boundary geometry, but I can continue them in a different sense to a continuous constant B field on the inside. And that sector we interpret as an SE2BF sector in the asymptotics. Now this here, I think this is quite spectacular. We construct from some representation theoretic ideas, some nice Gupta-Bleuler quantization in one case, or coherent state ideas in the others, or just some, just representation, direct representation theoretic ideas of the four-dimensional groups. Some amplitude, we feed it a discrete geometry, and it gives us back the discrete Einstein-Hilbert action. It's wonderful. I mean, of course, we constructed it in such a way to maximize this happening, but it's very non-trivial that this actually happens. So, very happy with this. Well, this, maybe not so happy. Certainly, this, that might mess up things. Once we glue many of these together, once we look at more configurations, they don't seem to be so problematic once, as long as we're not looking at more complicated objects than the single vertex, because then they're always just nicely separated. They occur in a different part of the boundary phase space than the good geometric sector. That's an achievement of the new models, by the way. That's not the case in the Barrett-Crane model. But this cosine here, well, there are different opinions on it, actually. It really depends, I think, at this point on whether this is a problem or not. Depends on where you're coming from in these different directions that I gave to you before. It's sort of related to, if you want to think of this as sort of a projector on the solutions of the Hamiltonian constraint, that's real, so you're kind of expecting the cosine to be there. you want to think about it more like a path integral, like Machine was introducing it yesterday, then this comes down to the question, what type of geometries do you want in your path integral? Do you want to have just positively oriented or both? Do you want to also sum over orientations? And there I don't know what the right answer is. I mean, famously, Witten changed his mind on the status of 3D gravity over this precise issue. I think it would be good to understand more of that, but it's a very hard problem mathematically, even in 3D, to get a good grip on this in a sort of satisfying way, where I won't define satisfying to you. So that is what we found out with the asymptotics. What's going on? Well, who are the people involved in this? Let me briefly step back and give you a little bit of an overview here. The first vertex amplitude that was defined in purely representation theoretic ideas, not actually with the picture that I just gave you, but in a slightly different way, was by Barrett and Crane. That kind of kick-started the whole field, late 90s. Barron Williams gave the asymptotics of this very quickly. Bass Christensen and Greg Egan, who's a wonderful science fiction author, read his books, they're great, worked out that there were some pieces missing. They essentially found this topological sector that had been overlooked in the analytic work before. Barrett, Steele, and Friedel and Duarte then understood all of this. And remarkably, there's still things we're finding out about the Barrett-Crane vertex asymptotics. Kaminsky and Steinhaus are just working out the measure factors, didn't really tell which measure factors, but the more measure factor aspect of this asymptotic. So there's still things to learn even in these old models. Then the Barrett-Crane model suffers from certain problems in the interpretation of the boundary geometry. We got a whole new slew of models. They're all very similar, very, very similar idea, actually great convergence of ideas from many different perspectives. They were developed by Engler, Pereira, Rovelli, Levin, Friedel, and Krasnov about 4 or 5 years ago. We got the first understanding of the asymptotic geometry of this was given by Conradi and Friedel, 2009. Then the Nottingham group, which I was a part, over the next 2 years developed the vertex asymptotics of these, including generalizing it to the EPRL model, giving the correct boundary treatment, and finding the interpretation of the SE2DF sector. And Mushin and Sang showed us how to combine these results and give sort of a very generic treatment on a very generic sort of two complex where you glue a lot of these vertex asymptotics together. In the meantime, there has been a lot of work on trying to eliminate this BF sector and on treating the cosine. I'll just mention a few people.
Benjamin Bond, Bianca Dittrich have
looked at these. I think Jonathan Engler most recently gave a proposal how to eliminate the BF sector and the cosine at the same time.
Daniele Uriti and Etra
have given similar proposals already in the, I think, early 2000s.
And Ryan Speziale have given sort of this glue and have given different proposals on classical perspective of how to eliminate these sectors.
Then more recently, we also have a new class of models that have been proposed where we don't know as much about the asymptotics, but since they're based on the same sort of classical geometric ideas, we expect the asymptotics to more or less come out the same way.
Right, so that is... Yes, so
this is the vertex asymptotics. These are the people who did it. What can you do with it? Once you have this cosine of the Reggie geometry, once you have this understanding of what happens when you feed the classical discrete geometry the quantum amplitude, you can do a lot of things with your amplitude. You can take your amplitude and you can put some observables on the boundary. Some of these observables, for example, can have the interpretation of a propagator, of the propagator that tests how a perturbation in the gravitational field would go from one side of the simplex to the other. There was a lot of work on this. This was the work that first unraveled that there are severe problems in the boundary interpretation of the Barrett-Crane model. You can also simplify your boundary. You can go to dipole boundaries, in which you get those by taking the four simplex that I showed before and collapsing 3 points together, so to speak. You end up with a much simpler structure where you can then calculate more. You can try to extract some sort of homogeneous sector from that. lot of work on that happened. You can try to put an effective action into the bulk when you put many of these asymptotics together. It's the work done by Mikovic and Bojanovic. And you can even calculate something like radioactive corrections, which means you take a very particular kind of sort of infinite triangulation and try to absorb it into an effective change of the amplitudes. So all these results can be done using the vertex asymptotics. We get a great test of our understanding of the geometricity of these amplitudes. The bound reaction can be tested, and we get the operators. However, what we don't test is the dynamics. And what we don't test is the continuum limit, because we're always working with discrete geometries that we put in, essentially. At least that's my view. There's also some people disagree on this. But in my view, in these asymptotics, we're always putting in some sort of discrete boundary geometry. So I'm going to ignore this refinement issue in the continuum physics for the moment. I might get back to that. But mostly, I will ignore it because I have not that much to say on it, other than speculation. However, the sum over representation here that would help us understand the dynamics, that is something we can actually study through asymptotics. Now, just briefly, why do I say the sum over representations gives you the dynamics? Well, after we've taken sort of, when we are looking in the large J regime, we need to kind of sum over the J and the I data in the partition function to see how these weights actually behave. Turns out that the sum over the I's, that's relatively tractable. You can do that. But it's the sum over J's here, the sum over representations, that's really kind of been baffling. We never really kind of got a good grip on what it should be. And in particular, the one result that actually had a kind of very indirect way of addressing this, that was the work of Valentin Moisson in 2009, indicated that in this, we might actually be facing a problem. That is, this variation, or this sum over J, might introduce equations of motion that we don't want, in particular, flatness. That is, in the inside, we don't get nice curved geometries, we just get flat geometries. Now, this is something we can actually study through the asymptotics. How do we study this through asymptotics? Well, we just generalize the thing that we did before on a single vertex to the entire partition function. We start with a boundary. So here I have a general two complex with a boundary. I put a Simone Speziale heterogeneous living coherent state on that boundary. I have a partition function on the interior that lives in the boundary Hilbert space. I take the inner product of the two. I introduce a scaling lambda in front of the spins J. And I study what happens when lambda gets large. So I take, without making any further assumptions on the interior, the structure of the result will be very similar to what I had before. First, asymptotically, this boundary state turns into a discrete 3D geometry on the boundary, not necessarily continuous. I feed it to the partition function, and the partition function needs to tell me what type of continuation of this boundary geometry on the interior it wants in order to not vanish, basically, not be exponentially suppressed. What does it tell me when we do this? It tells me that I have to have a continuation into the interior that satisfies geometricity conditions. So the discrete geometry on the boundary has to continue to a discrete geometry on the interior in a continuous way. However, it can be mixed with the topological sector I showed you before. It can also be just the topological sector. So, but in principle, there is a geometric sector in there that behaves just as we wanted to, except that I also get a condition of this form. Now, gamma is the Mirsi parameter that you already heard about yesterday that parameterizes these models, and that is important for the relationship to loop quantum gravity to emerge correctly. And theta is an angle that, when we are in the geometric sector, has the interpretation of the deficit angle around the face. So every deficit angle on a face in my lattice sort of gauge gravity that I'm looking at has to be 0 mod 2 pi over gamma. There's only a discrete set of things. Now, we did this for the Euclidean case, so this is really an angle, but Mushin and others have generalized this to the Lorentzian case. There, this is a boost parameter, so we really get some sort of weird accidental constraints on the curvature in these models that we did not expect. It's exponentially small versus polynomially small. So yeah. Yeah, in lambda exactly. 1/lambda. So you have no polynomial terms in 1/λ unless you have this continuation. It's exponentially small. This is just the shape that all these distinctions that I'm talking about take. So which also yeah, I think that's it. So now let me get a little bit more into this is sort of the overview takeaway. So if you're not so interested in the details, well, here are the details. You can take a nap for a few slides. I'll wake you up later. This is sort of the theorem that we proved. Me and then Wojtek Kaminski. First of all, when you take the partition function like this, it doesn't exist generically. It's ill-defined. It diverges. That's an issue we have to contend with. However, the interior continuation can give us a grab on this issue too, which is we prove that the partition function exists if the interior continuation is bounded. And whenever it exists, it is asymptotically suppressed in the same sense that I mentioned, with exponentially small in lambda, if the boundary data allows no continuation into the interior. The interior continuation is given in terms of a bunch of bivectors, the algebra elements, if you want, and group elements on the interior. So for each edge and vertex combination, here, for each half edge, so to speak, I have a group element. For each pair of edge and face, I have a group element here. And for each triple, vertex, two edges that neighbor the vertex, for each edge and the face and vertex that neighbor it, I have this bivector. These get matched to the boundary geometry, to the 3D boundary geometry that I put in at the boundary. And in the interior, they have to satisfy this set of equations here. Now, what's this set of equations? Let me walk you through their geometric meaning real quick. This is the famous simplicity constraint, the linear simplicity constraint. If you ignore the gamma part, it essentially tells you that this bivector should live in a three-dimensional subspace of our four-dimensional space. So I should say these are all four-dimensional groups. Yeah. So this is SO2C or SO4. In particular, our theorem applies to the spin-4 case. So you take the spin-4 bivector, and it has to be orthogonal to a reference vector in four-dimensional space. So these all live in a three-dimensional submanifold, which tells us that, and they also have to satisfy closure. These two conditions together tell us that we can reconstruct three-dimensional boundary polyhedra from this. This is Minkowski's theorem, essentially. Again, as mentioned by Mushin and Simonen. Now, given such a bunch of vectors, bivectors, this sort of matching condition at the vertex tells us that these three-dimensional tetrahedra have to glue up into a four-simplex, into a geometric four-simplex, or the topological sector that I mentioned. And the way we go from the edge to the vertex is given exactly by the GEV elements here. This forces the GEV elements to be the metric compatible connection. Now, I have a bunch more equations here. The GEF, now I'm going to a particular gauge where I set all the GEFs to the identity except for one. I have this equation, which tells me that the product of the metric compatible connection around a face, so I start at an edge, and I go around, and I come back to that edge, to that center of the edge, has to be the same as GEF. Now, if GEF would drop out, this would just tell me that everything has to be flat. This is the case of BF theory. But here, we have GEF, so we don't have to have flatness. we can have a, it acts like a Lagrange multiplier that allows the metric compatible connection to vary away from flatness. And we also get that GF has to have the form that is generated by this sort of gamma twisted simple bivector. So these two conditions unfortunately combine to give us this additional constraint on the deficit angle on the face. How does this come about? Well, the metric compatible connection is torsion free. Here we admix a little bit of torsion to GEF. The bit of torsion that we put in is proportional by proportionality of gamma to the bit that is a dihedral rotation. But down here, the left-hand side is torsion-free. The right-hand side has gamma times deficit angle torsion. So for them to match, the torsion-free condition of the metric compatible connection tells us that gamma times the deficit angle has to be 0 mod 2 pi. This is the geometric origin of these constraints, of these accidental curvature constraints. Because GEF is just the exponential of this bivector. So this is, you have your tetrahedron, you have a rotation around it, but that would be generated just by PEFV if there was no gamma term here. If it was just simple, it would just generate a rotation around the tetrahedron, around the triangle. But because you're mixing in a little bit of a gamma, you're also generating a smaller rotation by gamma, or a different rotation by gamma within the plane of the triangle. This is what I call torsion here. But you have a better understanding of these things than I do if you say this is not torsion. Does this answer your question? Okay. Well, this one doesn't. This one really stabilizes the triangle. So what I mean when I say metric compatible connection here is really the triangle that sits in the face gets stabilized by this. So I think I will get back to that a little bit later. I think that allowing torsion in here might be one way to around this. But the geometricity theorems that we have, that we are implementing here, I don't know that we have a way to implement that yet. I don't think we know. But I'll get back to that in a little while, if you'll bear with me. I'll just want to mention a little bit more about the structure of this theorem. It's kind of carefully formulated. We get asymptotic suppression if the boundary data can't be continued this way. But the fact that it can be continued this way does not mean we don't have suppression. And that's good, so that in principle, we can get more equations here than just these. That's good. Because in these equations, we don't see the Reggie equations of motion yet. We don't see any hint of sort of Einstein equations for these geometries to satisfy. If it was just these equations, flatness or not, we would just find that all boundary geometries are equally good, whether they solve Einstein equations in the bulk or not. So actually, here there's this, in this little if, and the fact that this little if doesn't have two f's, is the space where the Reggie equations of motion can hide in this analysis. Secondly, we only give a sufficient condition for the partition function to exist. It's clearly not a necessary condition, and I'll get back to these two points later. How did we get this result? If you're familiar with the asymptotic literature, it may be a little bit surprising that we're even able to get a result like this. Well, in order to get this, we took a different formulation of the partition function, which we developed over the last few years with Benjamin Barr and Bianca Dittrich. That is very much in the spirit of the work of Pfeiffer and Erkel. That is written in terms of holonomies. Now, the fact that we're using holonomies rather than representation data is nothing new. That has been there from the beginning. But here we're really following sort of a very close relationship to lattice gauge theory. Let me describe this partition function to you very briefly. We have the same group elements that I introduced to you before. We have sort of a generalized connection that is not the connection that I was talking about before around the face that admixes the GEFs with the GBEs. We have two distributions of, that are a function on this data that get multiplied together and then integrated. So it's a kind of a convolution product of distributions. Now, the important part lives in here, in the E function, whereas here we have the measure factors. I particularly like this form of the partition function for a variety of reasons. For example, by varying E, you can have a large class of models very, very simply. It's parameterized very easily. The Friedel-Krasnov, the EPRL model, the Barrett-Crane model, but also BF theory. They all just correspond to different choice of E here. Furthermore, if you take E to be the identity, to be the delta function, the GEF gets set to the identity, this reduces to the normal connection. This just becomes lattice gauge theory with action given by omega. Why does going to this sort of convolution picture help us do the asymptotics? We have just gotten rid of all the spins, so clearly that makes it easier to treat the sum over spins because there's no spins to sum over. We've done that sum explicitly at the cost of introducing this convolution product. But, well, how do we access the large spin regime of discrete classical geometry in this picture? Here is where the new methodological advance comes in that is mostly due to my collaborator, Walter Kaminski. These are mostly his ideas, so all credit to him for this. Consider for a moment U1. You have a function on U1. You can expand this function in representations. So you have some coefficients in front of the representations of U1. What does the large n behavior of representations here, of the coefficients here, tell you about the behavior of the function on the group? Well, it tells you how the Fourier transform of this thing behaves at very short wavelengths. And these are not wavelengths in physical space. These are wavelengths on the group manifold. So I have rapidly oscillating behavior on the group manifold if my asymptotic coefficients are not suppressed. What is rapidly oscillating behavior on the group manifold? Well, it's non-smooth behavior, essentially. As an example, take Fn to be the just one. So you have the asymptotic statement that your large n limit is just constant, then this becomes the delta function. If it has some phase in it that depends on n, it's a delta function that is shifted. So we can go the other way. We can study the delta, we can study the behavior of this, the non-smoothness of these functions on the group, in order to say something about the large n behavior of these amplitudes. And it's not necessarily like the delta function, in the case of the delta function, it's divergence. It's really distributional, but more generally, we see that whenever these n's are not exponentially small, this is a general statement in sort of analysis, when these n's are not small asymptotically in the exponential sense, as I said before, then this function cannot be smooth. So it's this lack of smoothness, really, that we want to study in our partition function. And now this lack of smoothness, of course, behaves nicely when I multiply functions together, or if I convolute them. Not quite immediately. In order to really get how it behaves, I need to generalize my notion of lack of smoothness. Oh, no, this is just because I, yeah, this is just typo. Sorry. Right, lack of smoothness. Lack of smoothness is given by the singular support of the function. So where the function is not smooth, we could call it singular. We need a refinement of this notion of the singular support of a function in order to really study how they combine in a nice way. This refinement is the notion of wavefront set, which tells us not just where on the group manifold the function is not smooth, it also tells us where in Fourier space the function sort of is not smooth. So we get really a statement about the cotangent bundle of the group manifold here, rather than just sort of really a statement about the phase space, rather than just the group manifold. Now, these techniques, the wavefront set techniques, they were developed in the renormalization of quantum field theory on curved space-time. So they really are concerned very strongly with the question how this smoothness propagates when we convolute very complicated graph-based objects together. So they're really a very natural technique to use once we have the sort of convolution product form of the partition function. The other thing I want to emphasize at this point, the use of the Levin-Speziale coherent states is actually not at all essential in our analysis. It's actually just a second step in the analysis. First, we prove the statement about the wavefront sets. The statement about the wavefront sets is a statement about the behavior of the partition function given coherent states of a very general class in a large, or in a short wavelength on the group limit. So it's a very general class of boundary coherent states that are covered by this. It's not at all specific to the sort of to any particular class of coherent states. Now, because the convolution product of these wavefront sets is kind of so natural, we can actually pinpoint very exactly where all the geometric equations that I showed you before come from in the way, in the partition function. I think there's another nice feature that we obtain here, which is that the E function gives us these two equations. The fact that we're convoluting gives us the closure. The fact that we have this product of group elements in the argument of the phase amplitude gives us these parallel transport and orientation conditions. And the and the fact that this is sort of behaves like a delta function for all phase amplitudes that we've been considering gives us this fixing of the Lagrange multipliers. So this means when you now want to go ahead and modify the model for whatever reasons, to get rid of flatness or whatever else you want to put in terms of geometry, you know very precisely what element of the partition function you need to tweak and exactly what type of singular behavior you have. So it's kind of like a toolbox from which we can build, you know, modifications that might or might not be interesting for other reasons. Now, this flatness result, as I said, was first reported in a different form by Bonson. I think what we have learned relative to the work of Valentin is very much what the precise geometric origin is of this flatness, how it sort of comes about in the interaction of the Lagrange multipliers and twisted simplicities. Since there have been a number of works that have confirmed this. We just put out a few weeks ago our long sort of detailed proof, which we announced in last year. Perini immediately after showed that actually this extends, at least if you take the naive Jalen variation sort of approach, then this result naturally extends to the Lorentzian. Mushin Han gave a rigorous derivation of this and also gave us a sort of a double expansion, two-parameter expansion that he introduced yesterday. And Wolfgang Wieland has also found the same in the equations of motion of the classical spinner networks that you can see as underlying these amplitudes. So this last point is really, I think, is an important point, because what we find here is that this is not a problem with sort of the quantum amplitude quantization thing, some nebulous thing. It's really just the classical equations of motion that have this feature, this Lagrange multiplier mismatching. So it's not a, so this kind of tells me we need to change our input in the model. We can't just make minor modifications. I mean, Wolfgang disagreed a bit with me on that, so that's just my perspective on this. But okay, I think what we can conclude is that this feature of the partition function now, that's really a real feature. What does it mean? What does it imply? Well, that depends, again, what you think spin-form models should be. Here is one of the oldest intuitions that we have about the spin from partition function. How should we link it sort of to physics? Well, you know, you look at the asymptotic geometricity of the spin from partition function. You find you get the Reggie action. You find you get the geometric sector. So the entire partition function in this regime reduces to an integral over discrete geometries weighted by the Reggie action. This integral over discrete geometries weighted by the Reggie action produces for you the Reggie equations of motion. The Reggie equations of motion peak the entire thing on Reggie manifolds, so that are on manifolds that satisfy the Reggie equations of motion. You take a continuum limit, these manifolds satisfying the Reggie equations of motion kind of come closer to manifolds satisfying the Einstein equations of motion, voila. Continuum general relativity. Never mind that we never really got much, I think, beyond that first step here, and never really got very far with the second step. But I think it's fairly clear that at least with the models that we've considered, that we've considered so far, this approach really doesn't work. There are most of these discrete manifolds that you would want in order to get this variation over discrete geometries that should produce the Reggie equation of motion are just not there in the asymptotic geometry of the partition function. So you don't get all the variations that you would need to get the Reggie equations of motion. And I should emphasize this. I mean, I said before that there's these conditionals in the precise mathematical statements about the existence of the partition function. There are explicit examples of the partition function where we see that manifolds that should be there, that satisfy both the Reggie equations of motion and all the other conditions that you would want a discrete geometry to satisfy, are suppressed. So we really know that these are not there in this regime. So maybe there's a different regime that we should study. Maybe we should modify the model. These are all possibilities. I think if we want to modify the model, the spinner approach is certainly the way to go there. Taking gamma to zero clearly also seems to be a reasonable thing to do. We're kind of worried about getting the Reggie action in this limit, but okay. But there's another possibility, which is to reinterpret the spin from models. And this one I like, personally, I like much better. We're now in a very speculative part of the talk, I should say. Somehow the picture that I explained on the last slide always suffered from a sort of glaring defect, which is, at least as far as continuum physics is concerned, which is, how are we going to improve on quantum Reggie calculus? It's not at all clear how to do that. Now, if we take this result here serious, and for example, we go to the gamma infinity model or something like that, this suggests a different approach to taking the continuum limit, which is the continuum limit should occur at the same time as the large J limit. You go large J, you get close to flatness, but you also take the continuum limit at the same time, then the large J, then the curvature over many simplices still remains appreciable, and we can still get the sort of Einstein-Hilbert action in this regime, provided the product of the theta and the J scales in the right way. So it's not obvious that this is actually plausible, but this is not a new idea by me. This has been discussed also by many other people over the years. But now we really have a way to get to this kind of flat regime in a much more controlled way. So maybe this is actually something that we can use. This totally accidental discovery might be something that we can actually use in a positive way going forward. Now I have 1 minute left, so I'll just briefly tell you what I think is next. I told you we have two sort of conditionals in our, we have a necessary condition for non-suppressedness and a sufficient condition for existence. We would like to have the other way around as well, sufficient condition for non-suppressedness and a necessary condition for existence. The first one, or the latter one would be really interesting, I think, for applying this to GFT, that Aldo has shown us, because for that application, it also would be very good to extend these results to really get a degree of non-existence. So there's sort of the degree of divergence that we have in these models. As Vincent Rivasovas tells me that we always study only those spin foams that he doesn't care about, so that would be a way to go beyond that. And then a sufficient condition for non-suppressedness, that would be interesting for looking at coarse-graining schemes, I think it's kind of important to kind of connect to these two approaches. They have both made great progress by dramatically simplifying the models in a way that gets rid of the geometry. Now we have better control of the geometry. Maybe we can build specific models that kind of approach what they need in order to do their wonderful work, but also keep our geometric results. And with that, I'll thank you.
So time for a few questions. 1, 2, 3.
I have a general remark to all the works on which try to go to this, in which this limit of large J is considered, that this is not actually the way classical relativity is expected to emerge from quantum gravity. So, of course, every limit is interesting, and if you find something interesting, then this is your this is interesting. However, if you don't find anything interesting, then I don't see any conditions or limitations on theory following from this.
First thing first, Alejandro, Alex, very short. Alex showed us that the right semi-classical state ensembles for quantum black holes have both a large number of punctures and a large number of spins. That fits extremely well with and a large spin. So that fits very well with the behavior I've outlined here. So I think, to me, the important question is, sort of, do quantities like this become large or small? If a quantity like this becomes small, so the expectation value of the spin and the expectation value of theta, if this becomes small together, then taking a large number of triangles still will produce sort of a continuous integral over the Reggie action, and I think we over the Einstein-Hilbert action, and I think we can do a large J limit and a continuum limit at the same time. But this is very speculative, of course. So I agree, it's not at all obvious. I don't want to claim that the semi-classical limit that we study is the right regime to get GR. I think that's something that has been tried. It's contentious, we have different ideas. I can't claim that this is definitely the case.
Is your boundary data a classical Reggie geometry? And if so, do you need to worry that the curvature is only provided in planes orthogonal to the faces?
No, not a priori. A priori, it's just a bunch of tetrahedra. And it's only the amplitude that glues these together in order to form a continuous Reggie geometry. And it doesn't need to do so because of the presence of the topological sector. And I didn't catch the meaning of the second part of your question, but maybe we can discuss after.
Yeah, just a naive response, and maybe this is in line with Yurik's comment. Lambda is not a parameter of the theory. Lambda is not a parameter of the theory. We sum over the spins, and we sum over the triangulations. So why should large J at all? I mean, maybe the amplitudes are dominated by small J many simplices, and this is just not relevant for how the space
lambda is a parameter of the theory because I put it on the boundary, so it's part of the observable.
But if that sector is, why is that interesting? I mean, we don't live inside a Reggie geometry. Large piecewise.
For sure, I also want to take a limit of many simplices, and I think the best answer I have is from Alex's talk that. Maybe you know that the states that are the ensembles that are interesting for semi-classical behavior have both a large number of simplices and large J on average, but I cannot justify it further than that. It's like we get interesting results, and the results need to justify it, and so far as they do, and I cannot justify it more.
It seems like this is a look under the lamppost problem. You have methods which allow you to study a certain sector of the theory, but it's a priori, not the physical limit, not where we expect the theory to provide physics.
We're trying to get to good sectors by taking larger triangulations. That's exactly what this approach does, right? We're no longer looking at single simplices or few simplices. We now make statements about the entire partition function, no matter how much you refine it. So I think we I think this is exactly what we should be doing. And I can't, I can't really think. You want to comment? Or?
There's not much less time left, but I have a very long question, which I'm going to. No, just. No, just a naive question. In fact, so this wavefront analysis is analysis in phase space, from what I understand. And the phase space here would be holonomies and fluxes, and there are no spins. So when you talk about this wavefront set analysis and then spins, should I think that you mean the spins in some type of classical sense as the norm of the fluxes? Or
yeah,
if they
exactly.
are.
Exactly.
Okay, so there's no quantum spins. They're just.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker.